Welcome to the first episode of Season 3 of The Breach, your deep dive into authoritarianism and corruption in the era of Trump. I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein, and my guest today is Dr. Adia Benton, who's here to talk about the Trump administration's response to Puerto Rico, where nearly half the island's 3.4 million American citizens still lack access to clean water 17 days after Hurricane Maria made landfall, a potentially life-threatening situation. Adia is a medical anthropologist and a professor of anthropology at Northwestern University. She studies global health, biomedicine, development, and humanitarianism, and she blogs at ethnography911.org. Adia, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you were to give a letter grade to the U.S. government's response to Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, what would it be?
Wow, I'm really grade agnostic, but I would guess maybe a D. Residents probably think an F is what I would guess.
And what are the ways in which they fell short?
Well, from my understanding, so I should, begin by saying I'm not a Puerto Rico expert, but have lots of anthropologist friends and colleagues who do follow what's going on in Puerto Rico because for family reasons. And so I've been watching very closely. And I think what it seems to have gone wrong was the preparation, right? So knowing much about the path of the storm and all of these things and what people would actually need and the impacts, particularly on islands, one needed to think about food, water, and certainly like shelter and all of these other sort of water and sanitation issues. So where the U.S. fell short was in actually using the foresight that they had to plan properly for people to sustain their lives.
And what are some of the special challenges that Puerto Rico had in terms of a disaster response?
So it seems to me that when you're an island and when you're a colonial island, which most of my friends want me to always emphasize, when you're a colonial island, you're dealing with many of the restrictions and challenges of being a part of the U.S. without some of the benefits. And so we're talking about whether ports are open, how things move from ports inland to different cities and towns. We're talking about infrastructure problems that preceded the storm. So one of the problems that Puerto Rico had was its really deep debt, actually a debt crisis. And so a lot of and usually under these kinds of crisis situations, infrastructure is failing, poor, in disrepair. And so we have this problem with the electric grids. We have this problem with telephone lines and communications. So those are some of the problems. And then we have these health problems. Puerto Rico is a sort of, a tropical island. And so one of the things that I think people are concerned about are waterborne illnesses, the failure of hospitals to actually generate power and to keep people alive, and mosquito-borne illnesses, which are quite prevalent on the island. So ones like dengue, Zika, chikungunya.
The last time I checked the stats on the government website, it said that 50% of Puerto Ricans have access to drinking water. What does that mean in practice? Does that mean 50% are somewhere near where they're handing out water, or what?
That's a really great question. And I think the other question that you want to ask is not only are they close to it, but do they have enough of it, right? So one of the standards in humanitarian emergencies, there are these things called sphere standards that are supposed to be sort of like the bare minimum that people need to survive on a day-to-day basis. I haven't looked at the sphere standards in a while, but it used to be that you needed 5 gallons per person per day to be able to carry on sort of the basic functions of day-to-day living. And so I'm seeing people handing out like tiny water bottles. I'm not sure what that actually means. I do know that the Navy has the capacity to pump water out of areas and then filter it and send it back. So that's a really great question. Water access may also mean 50% of the population is within a certain distance of a water point.
And how are they actually handing out? Do you have to go and physically stand in line is what I'm saying? Because that seems to be what I'm reading. Because I'm concerned that maybe people who are already disadvantaged, whether being really young or really old or have some kind of disability, might be falling through the cracks.
And that actually is a concern. I've heard that people have to stand in line. I'm not sure what that means. I'm sure that's a regional difference, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure people who are very close to ports and very close to the big city, you know, close to San Juan are fine. Or by fine, I mean, maybe have better access points. I mean, I do know that people are standing in line for gasoline, and by the time they actually get to the front of the line, you've run out. And so there's probably like a triaging process for that kind of thing. It's, you know, it's really hard to know. I feel like what I've seen and what I've heard is that up until a few days ago, people were at crisis points for most of the things that they needed. So it was lucky that people were actually able to leave once the airports were taking people in and out, which was another challenge, actually.
Can you elaborate on what happens, medically speaking, when a population loses access to clean water?
Yeah, so I was actually on the CDC's website to, you know, just to see if they've been able to collect data. But usually what happens is diseases that are already endemic, so diseases that are already making people sick outside of a crisis, tend to ramp up in some ways. So in Puerto Rico, there had been hepatitis A outbreaks. There have been typhoid outbreaks. That's a drinking water problem. And so under these kinds of circumstances, those are the kinds of sort of water and sanitation concerns that people might have. One of my friends was telling me that her mother said they were seeing more conjunctivitis, so more like pink eye, essentially. And so they were trying to figure out if that's something that's fairly common. And it is. And it's in these situations where you don't have a lot of access to like water to wash your hands, and it's sort of a hygiene issue. So it starts to spread much more rapidly in these kinds of conditions. So, you know, I'd be worried about diarrheal diseases like I said, typhoid and hepatitis A, and the mosquito-borne ones. Because those, you know, obviously when you have these breeding grounds, all this water, you're also going to have a sort of uptick and people in sort of inadequate shelter, you're going to have this uptick in these mosquito-borne illnesses. And like I said, dengue is very serious. And so it's not simply just sort of like the public health stuff. There's also the treatment part. So if hospitals don't have ready access to water, how are they going to perform surgeries, minor or otherwise? Births, you know, deliveries, yeah. Labor and delivery is going to be compromised. So there are a whole bunch of things, clean, you know, just cleaning sheets and mopping floors requires all of these things, like maintaining a basic sanitary setting is going to be quite difficult under these circumstances.
How are people with chronic illness coping if they have to go for, say, dialysis?
Yeah, so if you don't have, if you're at enough electricity. So that I read a story, or I actually saw a report about a hospital that was, they were doing surgeries, they had sort of enough power, and then their generators ran out. You know, they ran out of fuel. Their power went out, the generators had run out of fuel, so they had no way of actually doing things like dialysis, or they can't do, I mean, I have to also think about people who have diabetes, who have to monitor their sugar, the kinds of monitors they use, the needles, I mean, so it's like a whole scale, like people who are probably on chemotherapy. So, you know, I don't typically talk about people like Pitbull when I'm talking about humanitarian relief, but Pitbull was actually known for he took a bunch of cancer patients. He sent a private jet to pick up cancer patients so that they could come and do their treatments. So yeah, it's, I think basically when hospitals have little access to those sort of basic infrastructural things, they can't do their work. So, of course, you know, there are a whole range of chronic illnesses that require like sort of ongoing monitoring. And if the kits aren't there and the electricity isn't there and all of that other stuff, it just sort of destabilizes the health situation in a place.
If you've got potentially millions of people who don't have potable water still, are those people, is it a life and death emergency for a lot of those people or some percentage of them still?
I mean, I would say yes. So you think of all the things you can't do without water. You need it to live. You need to drink it. You need to bathe in it. You know, it's an unfortunate thing. Like I said, it sounds like the Navy is trying to help that situation. And in fact, that is one of the capacities of U.S. armed forces. I've been thinking a lot about the fact that there are all of these bases on Puerto Rico, like military bases on Puerto Rico, but those weren't immediately useful, if I'm going to take Trump's word for it, weren't immediately useful for deploying aid. And so that's another thing that I think is a part of this kind of strange colonial relationship between Puerto Rico and the mainland is, you know, how these places become staging grounds for all kinds of managing strategic risks, except from the place where they're actually based. So, you know, I had this interesting conversation once with this guy was driving me around Philadelphia. And he said, you know what, I work for the military, and he worked in the former Yugoslavia. And he was talking about, he says, if you, and I told him about the Ebola outbreak. And he said, you know, when the U.S. military says that it can't do something, it's lying. You know, we can create whole new water systems in places. We can sit down, purify water. We can build shelter. We can do this. We can do that. You know, when you hear that that is not possible in a certain amount of time, they're lying. It's because they don't want to do it. And that's the sense that I get from this kind of situation, which is that there's military capacity, but there's not the political will to deploy those at the capacity to which they can actually work.
I mean, the numbers, last I looked at them today, are really striking. The differences that there have been 14,000 people deployed, according to the government website, for Puerto Rico, compared to 31,000 for Harvey and 40,000 for Irma.
That's telling. And I'm not even sure what it's telling me, except that it probably says something about the value of lives and how those are kind of ascribed to certain people and not others. And the Puerto Rico situation sounds pretty dire to me still. There are quite a few grassroots organizations working. In fact, that was the only sort of good list that I could get. I was not sure what the U.S. government was doing with those people that they deployed, which I think is a really important point. And again, if I go back to the Ebola outbreak, you know, the U.S. promised 3,000 troops. And what I learned was, and over time, was that those 3,000 troops were not providing healthcare. They were trying to minimize their risk. They were building facilities that ultimately weren't used. And so I would wonder not just how sheer numbers tell me so little, if I don't know what it is that they're trying to do, what their strategic objectives are for trying to make life livable for people who've had to remain on the island.
General Honoré, who headed up the relief efforts after Katrina, said that he would have put 50,000 men on the ground in Puerto Rico if it were up to him.
Wow. I think that that does tell you something, because Katrina wasn't a success either, right?
No.
And I mean, hindsight is 2020, but you know, Honoré has actually been pretty outspoken, as you know, and I think he actually hit the nail on the head by talking about this colonial relationship. I also thought it was very interesting, given his own positioning, as I think he's from Louisiana, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, yeah. and identifies as an African-American Creole person, which is, so I'll step back a second and say why I think it's interesting. One of the big debates, sort of rhetorical debates going on, is whether you should be talking about Katrina and Puerto Rico at the same time, or this the Caribbean and New Orleans at the same way. And many scholars of the region say, absolutely yes, these are entangled geographies. These are places that have shared history in terms of how they've been positioned as colonial sure. era. And so, you know, for him to kind of point out that, hey, this is a situation in which the sort of, I guess, the lower status of people living in these coasts, you know, in the Gulf or in the Caribbean Sea, have a particular shared relationship of being devalued in this sort of global brotherhood of sovereign states. Puerto Rico is obviously not a sovereign state. neither is New Orleans, but there's certainly a connection, and it's ongoing. I mean, it's a long one that sort of has a long history.
That's a really interesting point. And you're saying it's a debate. There are some people saying that they shouldn't be spoken of together. What kind of arguments are they advancing?
Well, some of it's like, well, you know, New Orleans or Louisiana or that Gulf Coast is in this, it's in the States, it's on the mainland. It doesn't have the same kind of history, it doesn't have the same problems, or it doesn't have the same relationship. And so in terms of sovereignty, that may be true. But, you know, the way slavery, native movements and genocide, all of those things are all connected. You know, the French, the Spanish, and the English kind of colonial legacies persist in those places. And so, I mean, I think there's also something about kind of Gulf areas and islands that share kind of, I guess they're trying to say that there's the movement of capital and people has been kind of happening for for the same time. But yes, the people against are saying these are different places with different populations. The relationships are very different. You know, and I find that they probably have more in common than we'd like to think. It's a hard debate to have, because ultimately what ends up happening is people want to kind of rank them in significance. Whereas I think thinking them together and thinking about how what they tell about the history of the region, what they tell about the politics, what they tell about the potential to intervene in these kinds of crises is important.
It just seems that there, even if you don't take into account the shared history and geography, they've got something in common, which is official neglect.
Yes, that's a brilliant way to say it. My friend Yarimar Bonilla, who's a Puerto Rican anthropologist and kind of political historian, she talked about this as the archipelago of neglect. All these sort of spots of, you know, spots where people just don't care, like the crisis is when it really shows its face, right? So these situations have been happening, they've been ongoing, right? The crumbling infrastructure, the debt, all of those things have been happening for a while. And so in some ways, Puerto Rico has been in sort of, I think, I can't remember the guy's name, the reporter from CBS, I think, when he talks about this endless emergency, he's talking about Maria, but people who are observers of the region are calling it the endless emergency that's basically been going on for decades. So disaster study scholars or critical disaster study scholars are quick to point out that existing inequalities and rifts are intensified in crises like these, where infrastructure is destroyed, where access to basic necessities is limited.
And Puerto Rico, like the rest of the United States, has some very glaring inequities.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think you could see it in who was able to rebound quickly, yeah. Right? who didn't, right?
That Trump could go to that evangelical church and throw his towels like footballs.
I still don't get that. The image of that is in my head. And he was doing this sort of basketball thing. It was pretty sad. And there were people who were very happy to take video and smile with him. And those are probably the people who rebounded quickly.
I mean, the weirdest part about that was the story that said that Trump was about to throw tins of chicken into the crowd before the crowd was like, no, man, I don't think that's very safe. Our lives matter, remember?
Our lives matter. Please don't kill us with a can of chicken. Please tell me, were they whole chickens or were they just sort of shredded chicken? Do you know?
I don't know. They were like, I think they were sort of Spam-like meat tins.
Oh, nice. Man.
Like throwing a can of tomatoes into the crowd, not super safe.
Imagine that Twitter storm. I'm a little bit depressed about what's going on. So, you know, it's actually been a really difficult time watching all of this unfold. I've been kind of watching from behind, you know, behind my hands, just sort of,
yeah.
I just cannot fully invest, because it's every day there's something else. And this was one of those crises that I think could have been averted, but certainly there could have been a way to dull the impact. And, you know, it's remarkable how long it took for that response. Again, knowing full well that it was going to hit. We didn't mention the Virgin Islands, right? Right? So, there's also that. I'd say a good number. And you know, I was thinking a lot about this military issue. Like, so many Puerto Ricans, so many people who were from the Virgin Islands serve in the military. With what kind of rights as citizens. So those are the things that I think about too, like all of these ways in which people sacrifice for the country and the ways that their citizenship is somehow second class, like in literal terms, right? Puerto Rico, they don't have the vote, they don't have Congress representation in the same way, right?
Do you feel like there's this terrifying disconnect between the tone and the media? That before Trump's visit, the media seemed to be taking very seriously the fact this was a life and death issue. And then Trump showed up and the mass shooting happened. And now it seems like the tone has just relaxed completely, even though the official statistics are telling us some really dire things.
That's interesting. I hadn't. Though, you know, so there's a little bit of political theater. So one thing that I remember about Katrina And I think was this whole idea of going there, because the going there is part of the, I mean, I hate to call it political theater, but that's what it is. It's performative. It's supposed to be about intimacy and witnessing. And, you know, Trump finally got there, which I think is, you know, we're operating at where bare minimum presidential behavior
right.
is like, okay, now, like, we're at this point where we're like, well, at least he didn't, you know, press a button that set off a nuclear war.
Yeah.
So I would actually say, I think part of it is that he actually did the sort of part of the political theater that he willingly joined into in the political theater. Yes, he looked absurd doing it, but that witnessing piece was really crucial. And I sadly think that that level of political theater appeases some people. I think the shooting, it had the, I mean, probably drew attention away from what's going on in Puerto Rico.
And of course, they put him in the absolute best case scenario place, and the cameras had to follow him there. So the people that were watching the president got to see something that was much less dire than what was happening maybe even a few miles down the road. And for a lot of people, seeing is believing.
Right. And I think that that was definitely something that people were saying. Oh, I saw that he went to this place, but he certainly didn't come into this place. I mean, granted, he wouldn't have been able to pass some of those places probably, but he also has access to a private plane and a helicopter. So, you know, many of those places are probably best accessed those ways. If he were to do that, it probably would have changed a whole lot of change the perspectives. I don't know if you I'm pretty sure you remember this. There are all those pictures of George W. Bush staring out of the window.
Yeah.
If his plane, so he doesn't land, but he's sort of looking at the, sort of looking at it from above, you know, the sort of God perspective. And I believe Trump had a similar kind of perspective, but it's not an iconic one. But it made me wonder, like, what would have happened if we could see what they see when they're overhead. And we did get that from CBS, we got that from NBC and so forth. But I think it's lessened. I think it has reduced.
And also in Trump's own mind, I mean, even with George W. Bush, you had some sense that he was hip to the idea that his people were taking him to the nicest place for a photo op, if that's what was happening. Whereas Trump, it's like he has now seen things not so bad. I think in his own mind, it may have de-escalated the sense of urgency.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, he's a little, I mean, he's literal-minded. You're right. he's like not able to draw large connections amongst, you know, between things. So, I mean, in that case, are we starting to see how he sees? Is you know, and in that case, are we subject to the sort of apathetic, dumb way of looking at the world? I don't know. Am I going to get in trouble for calling our
president
dumb? I mean, seeing is believing, and he didn't see what he needed to see. And I'm not sure that he cared. And I believe that upon more than one occasion, he told us that he didn't care. And when people tell you that they don't care, we just have to believe them. You know, it's just, yeah. I think that's where we should be right now.
Yeah, he said that it wasn't a real crisis like Katrina.
He said it wasn't a real crisis. He also said, we're doing a great job. You guys look great. Stop telling us that we're doing a bad job. We're amazing. That's what he's telling us. That he that's what he wants us to believe. It's what I think he believes. I would say we should just trust that what he's saying is what he actually believes.
Yeah.
We can no longer pretend to want to read his mind and to imagine a better Trump, a deep down, good-hearted Trump. It is not there.
Or even a crafty Trump with like an 11-dimensional plan.
An evil genius. His PhD in evil. No, I don't. I don't see it. I don't think that if one has an evil genius plan, that they would be the president of the United States of America. To be perfectly honest, why not just be a billionaire? it seems like you can do much more that way.
Speaking of evil billionaires, what effect is the debt crisis going to have on the recovery? Because it seems like there's both, you know, this is terrible, they can't pay anything back, but then also both Wall Street and conservatives in the mainland U.S. are thinking, well, we don't want it to totally implode.
So Larry Summers came out and said, he did come out and say, we should cancel the debt, which kind of made me wonder, well, I mean, he considers himself to be a liberal, I think. his economic, I mean, in economics terms, which is a different sort of thing. I think there's probably going to be some relief. I'm not sure how it's actually going to manifest. So in other words, what I'm suspecting is we have to think of who has a stake in Puerto Rico and it's in the moment of crisis. So who, and in other words, how, who can capitalize, who can best capitalize on Puerto Rico and then argue that it will somehow improve this debt situation? My feeling is that it's going to be land investor types, sort of developers, right? Because that's the island thing. You know, the island where you don't need a passport is quite attractive in the tourist industry. I believe there's also been a pretty sort of, with privatization of education, healthcare, all of those things, but, you know, same stuff that's happening on the mainland. You've got this group of U.S.-based or mainland-based folks who are going there to set up charter schools and run, you know. And so I think what's going to happen is there may even be a sort of mass migration and land grab amongst wealthier people from the mainland is what I would guess. Does that answer your question? Because I feel like what if there's a way to make that look like a way to ease debt, like sort of change tax revenue base, consider investments in the island, I think that would probably be the way this goes. You know, just as the gun manufacturer, gun selling folks, their stocks go up after a mass shooting, I believe after a crisis, if you own stock in Home Depot, if you own stock, if you own stock in a bunch of things that help to rebuild, then you're probably going to benefit. In fact, that's what a friend told me. She said she was leaving a place in Puerto Rico and this financial advisor said, oh, the best thing that could happen to us right now is a hurricane.
Ooh,
and
that's dark.
Yeah, it's pretty dark. When she told me this, I was actually like, wait, what? And then she said something like, oh, and buy stock in Home Depot, which, you know, was, yeah, it was, she said she kind of stopped in her tracks and then this hit. And she, you know, she kind of was like, oh, so basically this is disaster capitalism. This is what happens. You have a blank slate. It opens the gates for all of these other sort of neoliberal projects, privatization of social services, the development of land, urban development for tourism. It's going to be it can be a free for all if people aren't. So basically what's happening in terms of aid and relief is lawyers are actually a part of relief efforts now because they're trying to help people figure out how they're going to make claims, right? How they're going to make claims, how they're going to maintain their land, their whatever ownership, right? You know, these are the things that are going to be negotiated in the aftermath. People are still settling for Katrina.
Yeah.
Who lost their houses. And so these are the kinds of, you know, so it's not just engineers, health workers, it's lawyers who are trying to help people keep their homes, keep their land, and actually be compensated for damage.
I wonder if there might be some kind of unholy alliance between congressional conservatives. The White House is already in favor of multi-billion dollar bailout, but Congress would have to approve it. And I sort of wonder if the threat of, you know, 100,000 or more Puerto Ricans coming to the U.S. mainland might scare conservatives enough to want to vote for it.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, there's so many Puerto Ricans in the mainland already. So I think if they're thinking it's going to change voting patterns, they might.
Well, I think it might actually do that because somebody calculated that if, you know, a significant percentage of those people went to Florida and they vote Democratic at the same rate that they've been voting Democratic on the island, that could be the victory that won Florida for Trump this time around.
Yay, bring them on. I would bet you'll see Marco Rubio.
Yeah. Which,
that's another, wow. It's, you know, I would suspect that there's probably that, and then there are also financial interests. I mean, most of our Congress people, or a good number of them, are wealthy. A good number of them probably have investments that would benefit from, well, maybe debt repayment, but probably also from development of the island. So I guess it, like I said, it depends on what people's stake, which stakes are higher, which stakes have the great, have the best payoff. You know, they can't really argue it's an immigration issue, right? Because it's people moving.
Unless they just want to drop the pretense and say immigration means race.
Yeah, they would have to do that. And you know, they're probably not going to all deny that. I mean, it's actually shocking to me how many people, again, did not want to believe Trump when he told them what he believed.
Yeah.
So now that they're seeing, and actually people are seeing it and still not ready to believe it. So I you know, I'm not sure what that means, but it's definitely something that's troubling in so many ways. So we will see. It's very depressing.
And Dia, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for coming on the program.
No problem. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to my conversation with Dr. Adia Benton, a medical anthropologist from Northwestern University. If you'd like to help our fellow citizens in Puerto Rico, you can donate to the Hispanic Federation by going to hispanicfederation.org/donate and choosing Puerto Rico Hurricane Relief from the drop-down menu on the bottom right. And now it's time for recommended reading. A hand-picked selection to deepen your understanding of our bewildering political moment. It's called Alt-White, How the Breitbart Machine Laundered Racist Hate, and it's by Joseph Bernstein of BuzzFeed. To make a long and very juicy story short, some emails of former Breitbart editor and right-wing provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos leaked to BuzzFeed. They show Trump strategist and Breitbart News executive Steve Bannon making Milo the public face of Breitbart's all-out assault on liberalism, which stoked the right-wing populist anger that helped sweep Trump into office. There's a lot of great stuff here, like the time Milo sang America the Beautiful at karaoke, while white nationalist Richard Spencer and his buddies did Nazi salutes in the audience. But to me, the most interesting thing about the story is what it shows about Bannon's attitude towards the raucous left-wing protests that often broke out at Milo's college talks. Breitbart sent Milo on a tour of college campuses in the run-up to the 2016 election. There was a big debate on the left about how to respond to these events. Should activists try to physically shut him down? Some argued that force was necessary to stop Milo's racist rhetoric, but others countered that force only played into Bannon's hands. In May of 2016, activists rushed the stage at a Milo talk at DePaul University in Chicago, ending his presentation. BuzzFeed said that Milo wrote to Bannon to say he feared for his safety and wanted more security. Bannon wrote back, "Agree 100%. We want you to stir up more." For Bannon, the disruptions were the whole point. Anyone who helped shut down a Milo talk became a bit player in Bannon's political theater. That's it for recommended reading. Breach is produced by Nora Hurley for Rewire Radio. Our executive producer is Mark Folletti. Our theme music is Dark Alliance, performed by Darcy James Argue's Secret Society. And I'm your host, Lindsay Beierstein. Tweet your suggestions, comments, and questions to @Beierstein, Beyerstein on Twitter. See you next week.